you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. We're attached to things. Our dwellings are packed with items we rarely throw out. Things have traditionally given us comfort, but they also give us status. The wealthy often collect things for no other purpose than to own them. But in an age where the great majority of us have too much stuff, is it not time to end this obsession? Should we all engage in a radical call? Or are things our only link with the past, an unnecessary part of who we are? Joining us to debate the status of things are behavioural scientists Paul Dolan, senior lecturer in psychology at Leeds Beckett University, Steve Taylor, and British broadcaster and anthropologist, Marianne Ojota. If you enjoy today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit our website, ii.tv, for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll now hand you over to our host for this debate, Eliane Glazer.
Hello, and welcome to this debate on the status of things. So should we end our obsession with possessions? Our speakers now have 3 minutes to put their case, starting with you, Marianne.
Okay, thank you, and good evening to you all. Okay, yes, we are drowning in stuff. I think we live in peak thing. But even in a secular world, I believe that things are sacred. Yep, sure, get rid of the junk, get rid of the stuff that you don't want, but a radical cull... No. If it means something, that might be something good. It might be something more complicated than good. I say keep hold of it. Literally, keep hold of those things. Yes, we live in a capitalist world that is driven by creating desire and demand. We're facing inflationary pressures, which means that it is your duty not only to put the bunting out this weekend, but also to go and buy stuff because otherwise the economy's screwed. Sure, but I would say that a future free of objects is going too far. A future free of objects is to, I think, basically profoundly misunderstand what it is to be human, how it is that we create meaning. If you have a world that is basically free of objects, free of things, free even of clutter, I believe we move closer to a world that is devoid of meaning. Stuff is the stuff that builds networks of connection between people and places, between the past, the present, and the future. It connects us, it earths us, it weaves us into a tapestry. It's how we write our stories. Literally, written into the objects that we surround ourselves, the objects that we gift, the objects that we sell, that we buy, that we collect, that we curate. When you look at archaeology, what you see is also that things of the past, things that belonged or touched the lives of people from the past, that it's the things, not the history books, not the kind of grand arching narratives, but the things themselves that reveal the details, the intimacies, but also the inconsistencies of how people live their lives. Because it may be the case that the Vikings converted to Christianity in, pick a date, the early 9th century, but then actually if you go metal detecting in certain places, bits of Yorkshire, or you look at the artifacts that might be in your local regional museum, there's a much more complex story behind them, a complex story where people are worshipping old gods and new gods, where people are combining, in the present sense, in contemporary Britain, stuff that is entirely rational because we're rational, secular kind of science types, but also stuff that is profoundly irrational. I'm sure you can pick of your own examples. So I say be messy. I say keep the clutter, keep the stuff. I don't believe in the eat clean, live clean, curate your feed. I say the details are the beauty of life. Yes, stuff used to be all about status and connection. Now stuff is easy, it's cheap. It's quite hard sometimes to get rid of stuff, but let's not make it a moral judgment whether you have stuff or not. Stuff is what makes you human, wherever you are in the beautiful rainbow of humanity. So yes, declutter, but no, don't dehumanize. Power to the stuff.
I don't want to be puritanical, but I do believe we should move beyond possessions. In moderation, I'm not saying we should throw everything out. Some things have a utilitarian value, some things may have some sort of nostalgic value. But I think we've been deceived by our culture for the past few decades by the materialist ethos of our culture, which associates happiness with the acquisition of material goods and possessions and wealth. We know, and Paul will maybe talk about this, but we know from research in psychology that happiness does not lie in the acquisition of material things. It does to a certain point, but once your basic needs are satisfied, it doesn't really matter very much, however rich you may become. In fact, research suggests that people who have the strongest materialistic orientation tend to be unhappier than others, whereas people who live a life of voluntary simplicity tend to be happier than others. You know, it's a bit like eating when you're already full. You know, if you've got what you need, why do you need more? It doesn't satisfy you. It just makes you feel bloated and sick. That's an analogy. And another point is that if you look back at the history of our species, we've spent 95% of our time on this planet as hunter-gatherers. And hunter-gatherers live a mobile lifestyle. You know, we would have stayed in the same place for maybe a few months and then up sticks and moved elsewhere. So in those terms, you know, possessions would have been a burden to us. Our ancestors would have lived lightly. So when economists or politicians sometimes imply that it's natural for human beings to acquire more and more, to want more and more, that's not actually true. You know, in our sort of instinct, if there is any such thing as instinct, it would be to not accumulate too many possessions because it would have been a burden to us when we moved. And indeed, contemporary hunter-gatherer groups who live the same lifestyle as our ancestors, they tend not to be acquisitive either. They tend to live lightly. And they don't really have an ethos of personal ownership. They tend to own things communally or just use things communally. So in those terms, I don't think it's natural for us to acquire things. And I think that's why it feels so great when you offload things, when you declutter. It feels liberating. It feels fantastic because in some way it's right. It's natural. It's right. We're not meant to be burdened by too many possessions. Possessions also take up our time and attention and our energy. I was reading about Jerry Seinfeld, the comedian who apparently owns about 95 cars. And I was thinking, you know, that's like 2 MOTs per week. And it's it's like constant repairs, insurance, breakdowns, worry about cars being stolen. We don't need that kind of complexity. So we need to live simply. Also for the sake of the environment, you know, every material good that we consume or use has an environmental impact. So we need to move towards voluntary simplicity in the future.
So I guess the first thing to say, it depends on whose obsession it is, right? I mean, we're probably talking, almost certainly talking about very rich, affluent nations and probably very rich, affluent people in those nations. Of course, if you're in poverty and if you're in poorer parts of the world, economic growth, the buying and selling of stuff, is one surefire way to be able to feed and clothe your children and families. So I think we need to place it in the context of a very affluent, you know, kind of setting that we're in now. And if we do that, it actually reminds me of the work of Thomas Veblen. I don't know anyone who's trained in economics, but that was my first port of call in academic disciplines. And he wrote a book on conspicuous consumption in 1899, which is about buying stuff for status. And that's often what we do, right? It's so we can show it off to people. And there's a number of attributes of status-seeking consumption. It needs to be visible. People need to see what you buy. It needs to be scarce. Obviously, not everyone can buy it. And it needs to be a very weak association between quality and price. Lipstick is a really good example. And clearly, that kind of consumption has spillover effects for other people's welfare. And so it's unsurprising that some of the data, not all of it, shows the negative spillover effects of other people's status-seeking consumption. Interestingly, when a lottery winner wins in your neighbourhood, there's an increase in people filing for bankruptcy. When other people around your neighbourhood buy faster, more expensive cars, maybe they own 95 of them, you're more likely to want to do that yourself. A lot of the benefits that we get from consumption come from comparisons to other people. So clearly, from a social welfare perspective, that kind of status-seeking consumption will be harmful. But like everything, it's just everything I say when I teach, context matters. And of course, it depends on the kind of stuff that you're buying for the kinds of reason that you buy it. And often we create narratives around the kinds of consumption that we morally judge to be good and bad. So buying a car, for example, will often be seen as a very bad material consumption. Sometimes it is. But sometimes the experience of driving is why people will buy a car. Sometimes the experience of watching a big television is why people buy big TVs. I say that because when I did a piece for The Guardian on what makes me happy a decade ago when Happiness by Design was out, I spoke about my very big telly. The very tolerant left-leaning Guardian comments section were not particularly enamoured with my big telly, especially as I had the audacity to say that I don't read novels as well, which was really quite insulting. But there is a class lens, actually, as a serious point through which we look at how people live. And I'll just finish on that point. I think it's important that we remind ourselves of the moral judgments that we make that often come from a place of our own privilege and not from the experiences of other people.
Right, so we've heard your pitches now. We're going to debate the issues. And the first section of this discussion is, are things an essential part of who we are? And if so, why? And I'll start with you, Steve. And I guess, is it worth drawing a distinction, perhaps, between consumerism and objects that really have meaning to us, personal objects we look around our house, anyone who's cleared out a relative or a parent's house after they've died, those objects really have nostalgic and positive associations and are bound up with memory. So should we draw that distinction, do you think?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but you mentioned this before, that possessions are associated with the past. I think, Marianne, maybe you mentioned that. And that is one of the issues that, you know, in spirituality, for example, everything is based on living in the present. You know, we all know that it's very beneficial to live in the present. That's the basic principle of mindfulness, giving your full attention to the present moment. And one of the issues with possessions is that they belong to the past, which isn't a bad thing, but if you orientate yourself too much towards the past, then you lose sight of the present. So I think in order to be fully present, you do need to let go of possessions, and you do need to be firmly focused on your present experience rather than the past.
I don't think you can really make sense of your present unless you do understand your past, because otherwise you're sort of floating in a nihilistic soup, an ahistorical soup. I mean, even if it's difficult, the way to live comfortably, sort of happily, you know, be in that present moment is to have made peace, perhaps, with your past. But sometimes that requires having that, I don't know, the guy ropes and the tent pegs that make you know who you are, who you could be, or where you've come from.
Do you think perhaps there's been a historical shift that in the past our possessions were to do with memory, family, things we'd inherited from our ancestors and so on? Nowadays, our possessions, our gadgets are about being in the present, perhaps in a bad way, that we're sort of scrolling through our social media. Do you think there's been a historical shift?
I think since time immemorial, your hunter-gatherer from the Paleolithic was kind of eyeing up the other guy's wolf skin going, Oh, you kept the head, did you? Right. Interesting choice. I've got another one back in the cave. I think that's just something essential about humans. And the point you made about hunter-gatherers sort of live lightly, I do accept that. That is true compared to, you know, the boxes of crap that are in my house, for example. But you can look at Neanderthal sites and people have curated stuff. They've buried loved ones with things. There's a site in Germany where they've arranged bits of hacked off stalagmite into a circle. And so they spent time with things making meaning in the world, in the material world. And I think if we entirely lose sight of that, we lose sight of what it is to be human. We're just complex creatures and we tell our stories through things.
And Paul, I think because you're a professor of behavioural science, I think about nudge theory and how advertisers nowadays are persuading us to buy things that we didn't even know that we wanted or needed. So are identities now being formed by our surroundings, perhaps our consumerist drivers who are pushing us to be who we don't want to be?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's clear that advertising works to sell you stuff often that you don't want or need to buy into a particular lifestyle. It's always an interesting question of whether historically that was, you know, how much has changed. Because I do think I take the point about we're naturally comparative creatures. That's part of the human condition, is to compare ourselves to others. So the basis on which we do that may, of course, have changed over time. But the fact that we do that is pretty much part of who we are. I just want to say something quickly on the role of nostalgia, because I'm someone who generally does live in the moment. I don't really think very much about the past, but the evidence is quite compelling on the role of nostalgia. It's a good part of human well-being to be reminded of times and places that felt better or good. And I will just say something about mindfulness, as someone who doesn't like it very much, is that there's a very... And of course, actually, the really important point to make about that is that there's a lot of differences across individuals. And anyone who tries to prescribe a one-size-fits-all approach is selling snake oil. But there is a nice paper, Causal Effects of Mindfulness Makes People More Sanctimonious.
Steve, would you like to respond?
I'm just saying,
well,
it's evidence. I mean, it's not me, it's evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Paul. There's a danger in any endeavour of becoming sanctimonious. And yeah, I've met spiritual people who are very sanctimonious, and they're very attached to their spirituality and to their idea of themselves as a spiritual person. But there's no denying that there's tons and tons of evidence of the benefits of mindfulness. Even in situations of pain, mindfulness has been shown to be beneficial in alleviating the symptoms of illnesses. So yeah, it's a question of balance. Everything is a question of balance. I mean, I agree with you that we do need to be reminded of who we are. We do need a kind of structure to give us a sense of identity and meaning. But I mean, the problem is when we're too orientated towards the past, the problem is when we're too orientated towards the future. We need a sense of the future and the past, but we need to be rooted primarily in the present.
And I guess
Go ahead.
That idea of sort of like being focused too much on the future ties into peak stuff, that you're always trying to acquire, you're always aiming towards the better car, the bigger telly. I do want to ask you about why you like your big telly.
Because you're not focused
sort of in the present either. What?
No, I meant that in a good way, because you're in my living room.
Oh, right, I see.
Yeah, that's what I meant. It was kind of meant to be a compliment, but it came out really badly. Right, let's go back, edit that bit out.
Nice. I take your point.
It's that striving, isn't it? Striving to acquire more. That's future base, isn't it? Wanting more. It's always wanting more from the future.
But a bit of striving is good, right?
Yeah, striving is good in some senses, but not in terms of like striving to acquire more things that you don't really need. Or
if it's striving within a community, maybe not so much the bankruptcy because your neighbour's just won the lottery, but if you see that the people who... I know this isn't quite how the world works, but you know, the people who've got jobs and their kids work hard at school and they've got the big telly, to simplify life enormously to a point of perhaps, you know, nonsense, that's a useful thing.
So this is essentially Hurstman's tunnel. So imagine yourself in a traffic jam with two lanes, both of which have stopped. The other lane starts moving before yours does. What goes off in your mind? Well, two things. First of all, I'm really pissed off I should have been in the other lane. That's the relative effect. But also, there's a signaling effect that your lane might start moving soon. And so when we look at relative effects of other people's consumption and other people's income, most of the time, in most of the world, it's that I wish I was in the other lane. But in certain cultures, in certain countries, in poorer parts of China, in India, there's a signaling effect. When other people do well, it's a signal that I might do too.
But there's also a question, coming back to identity, about do our objects say something about who we are as individuals, or do we live in communities where the group influences the possessions that we own?
Absolutely, because you form your identity by having that reflected back to you by others. I'm sure you'll disagree on that. but you also form your identity by identifying who is them, not us. So if those people over there have flash cars and that's not your kind of a thing, then you may well go to take a kind of stronger position in opposition to that. We're not the flash car kind of people. We're the tumbly down, you know, fix it together with a bit of you know, twine and gaffer tape and drive around, you know, north of Scotland with it. We're those people, you know.
And counterculture, I guess, would be an example of that.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, Steve, I was going to ask you, because in a way, mindfulness and meditation and minimalism, it's almost become an industry in itself nowadays. And some people might use that affiliation to meditation practice as a way to signal their identity. So even though they lack many possessions and they go for minimalism, subscribing to that culture might be a way of signalling who they are.
Possibly, yeah, but I would say that that's not really an authentic practice. There's this phrase, I can't remember who came up with this phrase, spiritual materialism. It's when spiritual people use spirituality in a materialistic way to sort of, you know, project an image or to, to collect, collect experiences or move towards enlightenment. But that's not the way it should be. You should practice spirituality with no real goal, just for the experience of well-being that it gives you in this moment. So I think really, spirituality is about letting go of external identity, really, and uncovering your authentic, essential identity. Buddhism talks about relative happiness, which is externally based on things or events or possessions. But there's also an absolute internal happiness, which doesn't depend on external things. It's just a natural quality of being, which you uncover. And the more you focus on external sources of happiness, the less access you have to this internal happiness.
Thank you. Do you want to quickly come back on that, Marianne?
I had that experience. I was making a documentary in Tibet and I was interviewing a baker in Lhasa, and he had been working incredibly hard to use the barley flour, the roasted barley flour that's sort of traditional there, and work out ways to make it rise with yeast. It's hard to do because you're at high altitude. And he'd done it, and he'd sort of like put together this like really offbeat cafe that sold a really quirky take on traditional Tibetan foods. And I said, "You must be really proud of what you've achieved here." And he looked utterly blank. Just, it didn't make any sense to him, that question. He was like, "No, but we had to cut and like carry on the interview." Yeah, because it just didn't make any sense being proud of what he'd done, because he hadn't done it. Even though he was surrounded by what I saw, the fruits of his labour, he had a different worldview entirely. And it did stop me in my tracks, yeah.
Wow.
Wouldn't have thought to put it on Instagram.
His stuff, yeah. His stuff wasn't his to kind of own or claim. So fair point.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to move on to our second section of this discussion, which is about these advocates from the past. Were they right to advocate getting rid of our stuff? So we're familiar with Marie Kondo now telling us to throw out our stuff. Gok Wan suggesting that we should only own 5 outfits. So we're constantly being encouraged to declutter and have less stuff. But how far should we actually take it? Because if we look back into history, Jesus and Gandhi, figures from history, have also advocated that we get rid of things. So were they right, Paul?
It's hard to argue with Jesus and Gandhi, isn't it? I mean, that's set myself up for a bit of a fall with that, wouldn't I? Best not do that then. But I mean, I do think it's really important to account for the externalities of our behaviour, good and bad, right? It's not just about whether as individuals we should be living in particular ways. It's the impact of our actions on other people. And as I say, I mean, the gains from economic growth at lower levels of income are significant. It literally saves lives. So if we are going to move away, and I completely agree with Steve that we reach a point where we have just enough, and we keep saying more please, and there is a point at which we need to rein ourselves in and to calm down and chill out and pay attention to life's experiences more rather than the accumulation of more stuff. If we are going to do that, we need to create markets that provide productive goods and services that generate growth of a different kind that will enable people to get out of lower levels of income and so on, and poverty. And that does actually remind me of 2 things to say, one that we've really spoken a bit more about, but that we should speak a bit more about, which is the sustainability of the consumption. I mean, I think that's a really significant point. It's not consumption in itself being bad, it's if it has significant environmental impacts, we need to be much more careful about that. And so considering about sustainable consumption, and we can all do that by having fewer children. That's a really significant way to reduce our CO2, or maybe getting rid of ones that we already have. That's an even better one, and to reduce inequalities. I mean, that's really there's actually a really cool paper that looks at search terms on Google by U.S. states based on the inequality that exists within those states, and there's greater searches for status goods, for consumption goods, for brands in the more unequal states. So consume the shit out of life, but do it sustainably and in ways that reduce inequalities.
Steve, interesting that list of advocates that I mentioned. I mean, Jesus and Gandhi, it's interesting thinking about the values that lie behind the injunction to get rid of stuff. I mean, Jesus and Gandhi, clearly, a very different value system perhaps to Gok Wan and Marie Kondo. But I sometimes wonder when I'm listening to people talk about decluttering, it's almost like modern therapy. If you tidy up your flat and get rid of all your clutter, you'll actually feel better and increase your well-being. So what about the values lying behind these?
I think Jesus and Gandhi were onto something. Yeah, I think they. I think every spiritual tradition emphasizes voluntary simplicity, you know, minimalism, not having too many possessions. I mean, in Buddhism, for example, Buddhism is all about moderation. The Buddha was a man of moderation. He followed the middle way between excess and asceticism. So I think that's quite sensible. It does feel fantastic when you let go of things. I took tons of stuff to the charity shop the other day, all my kids' books that they no longer read and old DVDs that we don't use anymore. It felt great. It always feels great to let go of things. And partly that is, I think, because it's natural for us to live lightly. But also, it's like a detachment, letting go. It's kind of liberating. You know, we feel that we need attachments to strengthen our identity. But actually, it's always liberating to let go of attachments. I once interviewed a guy who he was moving from Manchester to London. So he packed all of his stuff in a van and decided to pop up back to his flat for a cup of tea with his flatmates. And of course, by the time he left, he came out again, the van was gone. And all of his belongings were gone.
That's Manchester for you.
But he said for a few hours, he felt devastated. He was just shell-shocked and distraught. But he said by the time he went to bed that evening, he was filled with this tremendous feeling of liberation. He thought, wow, I don't need these books and records. I don't need this stuff. And it was almost like a transformative experience for him. He realized that he didn't need to attach himself to material things. And it changed the way he lived after that.
I don't know if that would be a sentiment echoed by people who've lost all their belongings because of a flood or because of a sewer, you know, leaking raw sewage into their flat, or someone whose life has been devastated by a natural disaster. I mean, you can kind of handpick your examples.
Yeah, I don't think that's a common experience, but I think it is, you know, I've met other people with similar experiences. People not just letting go of possessions, but letting go of things like success and status and achievement, that can be liberating too.
But it does remind me, I used to own a lot of vinyl, like serious amounts of vinyl, and I got fed up with carting it around every time I moved house. And in the end, I sold it and got CDs instead. And I really wish I hadn't. I seriously wish I hadn't. Because CDs are shit anyway, but also because... But what's really important about that is the nostalgia, is the experiences associated with putting the records on and the memories that we have of those experiences that get lost when the stuff goes. So again, it's kind of, you know, getting rid of stuff, but wisely. I think that's the key thing. And anyone who's got my records.
Marianne, I think there's a grave danger in this performative decluttering where it becomes a kind of a virtue stick to beat people. I've got people nodding going, I don't want to get rid of my dog-eared books and I'm keeping my vinyl. I say keep it. I came across a survey that was done by Lloyd's Home Insurance. So yes, they've got skin in the game. And they were advising people to, you know, increase their home insurance to cover all their delicious stuff. But the thing that was really interesting that came out of this survey was the stuff that is basically uninsurable. Your picture that's dog-eared and curled at the corners that's stuck up on your fridge that your niece drew for you. And you can't really remember what it is because the felt tip's, you know, worn out a bit. It's the, you know, the cup that your gran used to have her tea out of. It's that stuff. You can't just take a photo of it and say goodbye. I say keep hold of it, properly keep hold of it. In this Lloyd's insurance survey thing, it said that most people have about 9 boxes of stuff that, if they fessed up, they would call clutter. And I thought, shame on you for making them fess up. They should own it and be proud. But the other thing that really struck me in this survey was, I'm not on commission.
I was going to say, you made this survey really
interesting. I just thought it was a really good survey, really interesting survey. Not really in the way that they meant it to be, which was, you know, like buy home insurance. But anthropologically, 1 in 5 people hide things that are sentimental and precious to them from their partners. So things like a card or a letter that was given to them by an ex or something like that. They just don't want to get into the conversation, but they also don't want to get rid of the stuff. So they hide it in the bookshelf. If you get rid of all your books, where are you going to hide it?
Okay, well, let's get personal now. I mean, Steve, you must have some things that you guiltily hoard.
Not really, actually. I had a weird experience recently. Well, it was a few years ago, but I just thought about it a lot recently. When I started writing when I was about 16, I wrote lots of poetry, short stories, a few novels, 2 or 3 novels, unfinished, but partly written novels. And I stored all my writings in a box together with lots of letters from that time of my life. And so everything that I wrote from the age of 16 to 23 was in a box at my parents' house in the loft. So then I moved abroad and went to live in Germany for a few years. And of course, I came back to my parents' house and I said to my mum, what happened to that box in the loft? He said, well, I threw it out. I said, really? Yes, I thought it was...
You didn't say really, though, did you? You said no. Something else.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Something unrepeatable. So I felt devastated. But afterwards, a bit like that guy I mentioned earlier, I felt a kind of sense of liberation. Do I really want to read all these terrible poems that I wrote when I was 16, all these rubbish half-written novels? So in a sense, I feel quite liberated because I don't have those belongings from that period of my life.
Would you have liked if just a couple had found their way to salvation and that actually could go, oh, yeah, I was kind of, I don't know, really good, really rubbish, full of myself, whatever, you know. I'm sure you were really good.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'd be surprised and they were actually quite good, but I don't think so.
And Paul, if not the TV, what would you be willing to give up? If you had the time
would have
to
set my kids at some at one point, but probably not now. They've been around too long. What would I give up? I actually don't have a lot of stuff at home anyway, you know, clutter-wise. You know, clothes, if I haven't worn them for a year, then I don't keep them. I do think giving stuff away is really good point Steve made, though. I mean, if you are going to get rid of anything, find a home for it. It's a boring answer, isn't it? I can't really think of anything that I would get rid of.
CDs?
Don't have them anymore. I know, you just use Spotify.
Would your family agree, do you think? Or I think, oh, God, cupboards full of...
No, we haven't got... We actually haven't got very much... We haven't got very much stuff at home. I don't think the kids have got a great deal.
Marianne?
Certainly not parents that look at...
What would you...
I don't think there's any...
Do you have like a really carefully curated collection of something really odd? I feel like maybe you would.
So you think I would? Is that what you think? Okay, well, it's interesting you would think that of me. I don't know what I've got curated. No, I don't know if we've got anything. I don't know. I'm trying to make something up now, make myself sound interesting, but no, nothing.
If you had time to declutter, what would you get rid of?
Do you know what? Whenever I go to a charity shop to give a bag of stuff over, I end up coming out with last weekend, I went into, it was like a charity furniture shop. We were looking for a kind of wardrobe. We thought we'd buy secondhand. Don't want to increase the, you know, stuff in the world. I came out with a little set of wooden mushrooms, like little toadstools. All they're going to do is sit on the windowsill and collect dust. But I love them. They're brilliant. Someone gave me a Toby jug for my birthday. I was made up.
Okay, well, let's turn to the future. So would a future with a minimalist, anti-consumerist ethos actually be a happier one, Marianne?
No. Ooh, I don't know.
Take out anti-consumerist. Let's just sit with minimalism. Yes.
Yeah. Minimalist, no. So I think there's definite truth in the idea that people who are focused on curating a kind of a luxury lifestyle, or luxury equals success equals happiness, then you're onto a loser. You're not going to be happy. But I think by attempting to ascend from the messy and material reality of our messy material lives, we lose something of ourselves. And I think it is really easy to have lots of stuff. Stuff is quite cheap. It might not be good quality stuff. It might not be stuff that lasts. But you can go to your local supermarket and fill up with stuff. You could go to a charity shop and get a lot of stuff for, you know, and a change from a tenner. So keep your stuff. Be selective, perhaps. But I think moving towards no things is to lose sight of how we tell our stories. And we potentially deny our loved ones a way of them telling stories about us. Complex, messy stories that are the things where you've got your chipped plate or your chipped cup that is pretty rubbish. And if you did give it to the charity shop, they'd chuck it out because it's not sellable. But it means an awful lot to us because we're messy, irrational, emotional, material creatures.
And Paul, I mean, hear about charity shops, we're all told we should reuse and recycle, we know this, but actually green consumerism is on the rise. So how can we be nudged, or how can we nudge ourselves into making better decisions for the future?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think being made alert of the impact of a particular consumption item will be good. I mean, information doesn't always do the trick. It needs to be transparent and salient and very clear and intelligible to people. But we could do more of that, I think. We could do more for that. I think it's interesting that what you're saying about stories, because one of the things we don't have very good data on the role of conversations in people's happiness and well-being. It doesn't lend itself to the kinds of quantitative analysis that we typically do in happiness research. But as many of us will be aware, our well-being and happiness is located in the conversations that we have about things. and about experiences. And I think it's thinking about ways in which those consumption items become experiential. One of the reasons some people may know this evidence that we think that spending money on experiences is for people's happiness better than spending it on stuff is because of the conversations that follow. You know, when we come to a festival like this, we talk about it a bit more afterwards. When we buy a pair of shoes, there's only so much you can say about them. And so if we're going to consume things, then I think we need to be reminded or remind ourselves that it's in the conversations that we have about them that we'll experience well-being.
And I'm glad you mentioned experiences, because that has been a big shift. But I wonder, Steve, you know, it, almost as if experience industry is also on the rise, that all of our time is being, in a way, commodified by the kind of need to make memories and capture experiences and you know, spend money on every minute of our time, make sure it has value in a consumerist sense. But would your happy future be just kind of doing less of that commodification of the present and just, you know, staring into the middle distance?
Possibly. I mean, I think we need to focus on being rather than having and wanting or even thinking. You know, there's so much happiness that comes from just being that we forget because we're so focused on gaining things or doing things. You know, it's a shame that, you know, most people's free time now is so commodified and so filled up with entertainments and distractions and activities. Because actually, you know, for me personally anyway, the deepest well-being comes from not doing anything in particular, just lazing around, you know, not watching a screen or maybe just walking around leisurely in a natural environment. That's where true well-being is. That's when you really connect with your innermost self, not when your attention is externally focused. So I think any movement towards a future without wanting or having is a very desirable outcome.
But just to follow up on that, I mean, they're great apps now to help you in your meditation. I mean, where do you sit on those, the consumerification of meditation? Does that get people into meditation, or does that sort of stop you really just doing nothing, staring out the window, as you've been saying?
Well, I mean, if it's done authentically and properly, meditation is not consumerist. It's about moving away from those external identities and external desires. It's about sort of basically about slowing down your mind. It's basically about slowing down the surface of your mind and attuning to deeper aspects of your own being, of your own consciousness. And once you've switched into that, then you don't need things to the same degree. You begin to let go of things because you've found an internal source of happiness which is deeper and stronger than external sources. And once you've gained access to it, you know it's always there. You can always return to it.
Do you not think that humans are fundamentally makers, though? We use our amazing tactile, smart hands to make stuff. Because if we make, we want to give, we want to share, we want to use. And to separate from things is to deny that essence of ourselves, which is about making.
I think we are partly makers, but I mean, we are human beings. We're named human beings. We don't spend much time being. We're kind of ironically, paradoxically named, but we could be called human doings or human makings. But yeah, it's a question of moderation. We do have a very creative side of us, but we also should have an inactive, a restful side of our nature, which doesn't engage in activity all of the time.
Right, and thinking about making makes me think, you know, tech is such a big part of this, isn't it? That in a way, Silicon Valley tells us to be minimalist, to get rid of all the clutter and the books and the CDs and everything. But actually, ironically, then we buy more stuff in the form of gadgets. So tech's a big part of this story.
Exactly, and then they sell you a bit of a cloud rather than a piece of paper. It's not actually denying the stuff, it's co-opting your stuff. That you're not gonna, if you want to sketch, you don't sketch on a notebook, you sketch on your iPad, and then, I mean, you could delete the file, and that really is, you know, losing stuff. But that's like walking into your parents, putting your 16-year-old poems on the bonfire. I mean, there's some tension, there's some breakage there, I think. To kind of have something where you can say, I did this, this is something of me. Some of my most profound experiences on archaeological digs have been to hold in my hand something that has been shaped by another person's hand. The oldest artifact ever discovered in the UK, it's a hand axe made by a species that isn't even human, probably, it's human, but not Homo sapiens, from about 800,000 years ago. in Norfolk, an area called Haysborough, and it fits perfectly. Their hands were about the same size as ours. And it's sort of a multifunctional tool. You hold it in your hand and it's perfectly balanced. And it's got a cutting edge and it's got a hammering base and it just sits. And you have that profound connection of someone who is like you, but not you. And there's an amazing just sense of history and present and future and connection. And if they chucked that in the sea or smashed it up because they didn't need it anymore, I mean, frankly, I would have been devastated. I wouldn't have known it existed. People didn't do that. They didn't kind of carefully, you know, clear up after themselves. That's what archaeology is. It's mostly rubbish. Rubbish dumps of people's stuff that they chucked out or dropped or misplaced or buried incredibly carefully. But it is always of stuff.
Great. I love to talk about the value of rubbish dumps.
Absolutely, yeah. Rubbish is everything.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's thank our speakers, Mary-Ann, Steve and Paul.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That was cool.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit our website, ii.tv, for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.